Okay, cheers, buddy. Cheers. Thanks for doing this episode.
Of course. Thank you for inviting me.
Uh-huh. How's that beverage?
It's a healthy pour for the circumstances and the performance enhancement I'm desiring.
Everybody, and welcome to Busted Business Bureau. I'm Christian Borky. Today, I've got Minnesota's finest export and Chicago's second finest import behind Emily Lindsay. It's Archie Iyer. Archie, tell the listeners a bit about yourself.
Oh, you know, I'm from Minnesota. up on the old moose farm, my family grew up there. Yeah, you betcha, we're going to have a great time.
And is that true? Did you grow up on a moose farm?
No. I grew up in the suburbs of Southeast Minneapolis, St. Mm-hmm. Paul even. We would always go to Taste of Minnesota. That was always a highlight. The state fair, of course, the best one in the country, mm-hmm. in my biased opinion.
You're not putting on an accent anymore, and yet now I can't unhear the Minnesota accent.
Throw a couple words in there, and it'll slip back in.
Does your whole family talk like that?
Nope. Nope. Not in the slightest.
I have a piece of paper in front of you, and it is face down. Can you flip over the piece of paper and tell the listeners what is on it, if you could paint them a word picture?
He winces. Is a what appears to be three grown men, two in clown costumes, one just in a baby stroller holding a bottle of liquor, mm-hmm. going down the street with a bunch of people at a fair, looking at them, laughing, smiling, and a couple little boys really enjoying it.
And what's the comment under it say?
I recognize some of these clowns. My grandfather was in the Moose Lodge Clown Club with some of those other men. I don't remember the name of the ball clown who was supposed to be the doctor, but he had this fake needle that would pinch your arm like it was really giving you a shot. I hated it. I have pictures of my grandfather and his clown club attire and a event such as the Aquatennial.
Mm-hmm. And what is that original picture dated from?
1965.
And as that Facebook commenter alluded to, it is from the Minneapolis Aquatennial, it used to be a 10-day event, Aquatennial, that celebrates the beautiful city of Minneapolis. Now, I know you're not from Minneapolis. I know you're not an Aquatennial stan, but I figured you're close enough where I'm going to tell you all about a bit why we have the Aquatennial and some of the events that preceded it.
Perfect.
And we're on the Busted Business Bureau, so you know it's going to be about business.
I can't wait to be either very prideful or very shameful in Minneapolis.
Of the two, I feel like it's kind of like divorced parents if you're not from one or the other. Like, I assume you picked St. Paul because you were closer to, go to stuff.
Pretty much, but there's nothing to do there. You go to Minneapolis no matter what.
Oh, really? Hmm? I didn't know that. Like I said, you're seeing a photograph from Minnesota's annual Aquatennial celebrations. According to Aquatennial.com itself, the fireworks show alone is one of the top five in the country and annually attracts 250,000 visitors. The Target-branded Aquatennial fireworks celebration, it does not fuck around. Folks recommend on Reddit getting there 4 hours early to get a good spot to watch the fucking fireworks. And again, according to the Aquatennial website itself, quote, it's a pyro musical, if you will. It's the fireworks, which typically last 20 to 25 minutes, are a spectacle on their own, but they're intricately choreographed to music, each blast matching with a note or a beat within the song playing. So that's kind of the big final event.
Wow. They go all out.
They put their whole puss into it. And I have just one review to read for you of the Aquatennial post on Facebook. It's a good collection of community. I had real problems with a few things. Mostly, who invited the Jesus freak? Religion has no place in a municipal parade. Was he part of the art cars? Very disturbing. Secondly, the pageant girl stuff feels so outdated and puts women on display like chattel. I am a sucker for a pretty float and dresses, so I'm guilty of gawking too. Also, I am afraid you wouldn't have much of a parade without them. Is there any way to tell the city that when their ambassadors do the straight-arm syncopated waves, it resembles a Roman salute? With the rise of white nationalism, it might be better to wave like a regular everyday person. Dawn recommends the Aquatennial.
She has some gripes here and there, but for the most part,
she loves it.
She keeps her hands down and applauds.
So I guess that paints you a bit of a word picture of what the Aquatennial is still kind of like as of 2019. So, That's 2019, but I want to travel back to 1930, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Reading the front page news of a newspaper from 1930 feels like opening Instagram reels and just scrolling really fast.
I'm very curious about where that comes in.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to read you some headlines from paper around 1930. I'm going to link it in the description so people can read it on their own. I swear to God, I picked the most random one from the Minneapolis Star Journal or something.
Star Tribune.
I'm going to read you seven of the headlines crammed onto the front page alone. So the main headline, two die as blast and fire raise elevator. Woman's life sacrificed to save man with robot lung. Dog race organizer held for jury gives $500 bond and savage events are expected to go on. Vote for children. They have adult qualifications for office. Lon Chaney, man of 1,000 faces and movie star, dies. Peru president halted in flight. Home beautiful reveals charm without high cost. I feel like that kind of sounds like your Instagram.
It kind of does. It's like one of those fake TV channels on cartoons where it's just like, all right, we're going to every single thing you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Or when you're scrolling, it's just like, dead guy, beautiful home, thing about a president you've never heard of, mm-hmm. etc.
It's an AI-generated image of something impossible happening in China.
Do you get a lot of AI slop?
I think. I can't. I wish I could say I could tell better, but I can't. I don't look closely enough at, like, the fingers.
I generally agree with people who say that we're being, like, overfed information on our phones. You know, you could see all those headlines in, like, 7 seconds on your phone, whereas this was your thing for the day. That was, like, your newspaper for the day. But I do find some sort of comfort reading old newspapers and being like, we haven't changed at all. Like, this is still kind of all we talk about and all we do. And we've always wanted to know who's dead, always wanted to see someone's dumb fucking opinion, always wanted to see into beautiful homes that are nicer than our own. So that's what makes history come to life for me. But if you really want me to steal the deal on the fact that nothing has changed, would you like to hear a part out of the public opinion section from a Minneapolis newspaper dated Wednesday, November 1st, 1933?
I would love to.
It's simply titled, In Defense of Hitler.
Oh. All right, so this is the shameful part. We were talking about earlier.
And somebody, I didn't read the article he was referencing, but he got so mad that somebody described Hitler's policies as ballyhoo. So he was like, is it ballyhoo that Hitler is fixing the economy? Is it ballyhoo that he wants to ban homosexuals, which are a scourge on family life? Is it ballyhoo that Hitler is just being himself? I'm just asking questions. And I was like, damn, really nothing has changed. This, I mean, we've always been like this.
You also have to like imagine somebody in 1930s Minnesota saying the word ballyhoo in whatever transatlantic, like, oh yeah, accent combined. Zombie thing that
would like. You defend Hitler in a Minnesota accent?
No,
for me?
No, I'll pass. No.
So what was life like back in, what was life like back in Minnesota circa 1930? So I don't know if you remember this, but this kind of crazy thing happened where it was the Depression in 1929 to 1939. The stock market crashed, the events of which would send the country into the Great Depression, 10 long years of mounting debt, difficult climate disasters making things worse for the country, weird tariffs, widespread income inequality, crushing poverty, and, well, depression, gripped the United States for the shocking first and last time ever. Minneapolis is no different. I have a few stories about Minneapolis in the 1930s. Here's the shortest one that I have. This is just it's another fucking newspaper thing. Honestly, my newspapers.com subscription has paid for it in dividends in this episode alone. Okay, so Sunday, August 21st, 1932. The following ad is posted in a newspaper. I just like this ad so much because it, again, makes it clear that MLM schemes and other things have been around forever. The ad reads, create your own income. Because you have not tried this kind of employment before, you may have been accustomed to a paycheck. It's no reason why you shouldn't change your thoughts and your way of working. You cannot win what you want by wishing. You've got to act. Thousands of self-starting men have created their own incomes with this organization. Come and hear Mr. Cooper present a winning combination of sales factors, a golden opportunity for every earnest man who wishes himself in a profitable, stable business without investment. Call me at 678 Baker Arcade, 733 Marquette Avenue, Monday, 10 a.m. sharp. No other time. And it's like, the grind set has always been around.
Yeah, okay, Jordan Belfort.
So, that's a piece of what it's like to live in 1932 Minneapolis. Dial it back to 1900. Are you familiar with St. Paul Police Chief John O'Connor?
Can't say I am.
I'm excited to tell you a piece of St. Paul history that you're unfamiliar with then. In a political climate rife with organized crime, especially 1920 under Prohibition, but like early 1900s generally, organized crime is rampant. So St. Paul Police Chief John O'Connor comes up with the most brilliant way to keep St. Paul safe. He makes a handshake agreement with every notorious criminal that they can in fact stay in St. Paul as long as they want, as long as they bribe the police force and just don't do their crimes in St. Paul.
Law enforcement, baby.
I love it. So it's known as the O'Connor layover agreement, and it's the reason why basically all organized crime in the 1930s is centralized around Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota. Mm. Because they all stay in fucking St. Paul. They kidnapped, you know, Ham's Beer?
Yeah, yeah. Big fan.
There's a gang called the Baker Carpus Gang, as in like two gangs got together to kidnap Hams Jr. for a ransom of like $2 million. And they, I mean, like it was in the St. Paul area because they all just sort of hung around St. Paul because of the layover agreement.
They got bored.
They got bored. And then they got the ransom. Like they won. So anyways, this basically dumps a fuck ton of organized crime right into Minneapolis, Minnesota, because St. Paul is the haven for criminals. But again, even members of two rival gangs just like shake hands and agree, like, let's do crime together, boys.
Yeah. What the other alcohol brand are we kidnapping someone from?
They actually did kidnap a different alcohol brand. What? Yes. And I can't remember which, but they did. It was somebody
in
else.
Minneapolis.
Yeah. I don't know about if it was in Minneapolis, but they did kidnap another beer. Air. Anyways, so third thing I have to tell you, it's our last trip back to 1900. You know how in 1900 you could have a job like tailor or like textile worker, shipper, furniture upholsterer, job you could still have today, mm-hmm. but that's kind of like what people picture the 1900s are like. You've got major industrial people across the board who are interested in collaborating, much in the same way you've got those neighboring gangs collaborating, you know? So in 1903, the major industry leaders in Minneapolis, everything from law firms to furniture makers to bankers, come together and participate in this now national organization called the Citizens Alliance. And it's just in Minneapolis, like their version of it is just in Minneapolis. This is the one story, I guess, that's actually important to remember. The Citizens Alliance is going to be a very important character in our story, which the Citizens Alliance, again, is a converging of every single, like, major industrial business person in Minneapolis.
So not really all the citizens.
It's certainly not.
Just the rich.
Right. They're technically citizens in the way that, you know, they live here.
And aren't in law.
Yeah.
Besides that.
Right. But yeah, so you've got this rogue but organized group of business leaders who explicitly want to keep the cost of labor down. That's all they're here for. Their plan? Great question. So they have great relationships with the guys who own the banks in town. If a business has its workers unionize, banks would then threaten to no longer bank with that business. The Citizens Alliance was like, you will not be banking with places that are unionized. So that way, every single, whether you're in the Citizens Alliance or not, every business is discouraged then from, like, encouraging union membership more than they usually would be. The Citizens Alliance also frequently has newspapers publish articles about how union membership makes you a communist. And as you can tell, they'll basically publish anything in these fucking newspapers, right, including in defense of Hitler in 1933. So
right next to it, actually. Same author and everything.
So that's putting it broadly so that we don't get into the boring nitty gritty. But this is basically like a national union, if you will, of businessmen who are fiercely devoted to their own class, the upper one. They have crazy solidarity and a hatred for the working class. And it's nuts how blatantly anti-democratic that they get. You know what I mean? So would you join the Citizens Alliance?
If I was a businessman in the 1930s... I'd say, yeah.
It sounds awesome, yeah. Right? It's like so fucking successful for those 30 years that they enjoy what they got going on.
Reap what you sow. That's what we do.
And the effect of Citizens Alliance is this. Minneapolis has some of the lowest union membership in the country. By the time the Great Depression hits, the only way to make any money is to have a grind set and to create your own fucking income.
Mm-hmm. Show up on Monday morning at 10 a.m. only.
Sharp. And Mr. Cooper will tell you how to make $1 million. So the labor market is still absolute shit, and businessmen control basically all of the power, all of the wages, etc. So, it's time for a book report. Are we ready? The book that I found, honestly, I was looking at the Wikipedia page for the Minneapolis Citizens Alliance, but Wikipedia recommends great books, and I love reading the books. You know, you got to go further than the Wikipedia article.
Mm-hmm. Go to the source.
So the book for today's episode is William McKillen's A Union Against Unions, the Minneapolis Citizens Alliance and its Fight Against Organized Labor, 1903-1947. A bit lengthy of a title.
Yeah, a little bit.
One book review says that the book is like a crazy level of detail, but it's at the expense of there's no characters at all in the book, and it's really hard to follow.
It's just every single day for 44 years. They just say, and this happened this day. This new guy entered the Alliance.
Did you just whip? That was really good math.
Minnesota, top in education, I think.
Really?
I don't know, but it's not bottom. I can tell you that.
That was I'm in charge of like finances at the Lincoln Lodge now. And over the past 2 weeks, I've been going to the Google search bar and Googling things like 25 minus 3.
See, but it's Google, not AI, so you're doing the work.
I don't have a calculator app like ready on my phone. Well, I guess it's on my phone, but I don't want to be on my phone. Yes. Like readily available on my computer, so like the Google search bar is the first thing that comes up on the internet. So I Google 25 minus 3. And, like all of my tabs are just like, you know, 49 minus 27.
You got to open a new tab for it?
Yeah, I do. I always do.
You don't want to, you know, see your work and nope. Say, oh, okay, if that's what that equals, and maybe this is what this equals.
No. It's gotten dire. They should not have put me in charge. Anyways. Yeah, so anyway, we're a comedy podcast, so we'll do all the characterizing ourselves. You know, like, we'll make it seem like this a lived-in town. You ready?
Yeah, just tell me what accent I need to do when I'm in. I have a feeling I know which one it's going to be.
So, actually, I'd like you to do a Jamaican accent.
Yeah, I'm on.
Oh! I thought you were going to say no again.
Oh, you weren't telling me to praise Hitler, so I'm not going to do that. That was my qualm with that last one. The last request.
I found your line, then. Mm-hmm. What if I asked you to defend Mussolini?
Nah, I won't. Mm-hmm. Hang that one upside down.
Period. On June 16th, 1933, President Franklin D. Roosevelt enacted one of the most pro-union pieces of legislation of all time. The act, Section 7A of the particular act, stated, quote, employees shall have the right to organize and bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing and shall be free from the interference of employees of labor, blah, 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 and the designation of some, blah, blah, blah. Milliken describes this law as the Magna Carta for union organizing. Now, I don't know what that means, so if I wrote the book, here's what I would say. It's kind of puss to write that down and make it a rule.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Clearly gets it across way clearer.
That's what I'm saying.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Now. I don't know the fuck the Magna Carta is.
Chips? I don't know.
It's like what goes outside of inside of volcanoes.
Yeah, yeah.
As you can imagine, business owners across the country immediately get dunked into a boiling tank of water as strikes crop up across the nation. You know, like, they're now empowered by this piece of federal legislation, so they're like, I actually want my workers' rights. Consequently, the federal government establishes the National Labor Relations Board or whatever to mediate these disputes that immediately start cropping up, which, of course, now hundreds are going on yearly. In Minneapolis, clothing workers, upholstery workers, and Teamsters all separately start organizing, some start striking, etc. Forgive me for being, 3 years into my podcast, and I didn't know what the word Teamster meant for until now. Because I thought Teamster meant, like, kind of general union member. I didn't realize that Teamsters had to do with drivers, or at least it started as just, like, a driver's union, horse drivers.
Like a shipping kind of thing?
Yeah, like transport.
Okay.
Now, I think the reason why I got it confused in my head is because Teamsters are now such a big union, it could include things like healthcare workers in Rhode Island specifically, or like beer brewers in St. Louis are all part of the Teamsters union. Like, it's just gotten that big. But Teamsters generally meant people who do transport, truck drivers, horse carriage drivers, etc. That's what if you said the Teamsters union, that's the image that would have come up for people in the 1930s.
Yeah. Someone who wears like a forward, like a hat, you know?
A hat. Well, most like a hats, in fact, hat. Do go forward.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a good point.
It was like, you know, do you remember during the writer's strike when the Teamsters, I just remember this like Instagram infographic, Teamsters were like, we'll honor the picket lines. Yes. And then everyone was like, fuck.
To me, like, they're the enforcers right now. That's why I picture them now.
So, but true.
Now you tell me, like, beer brewers are a part of it?
I know, yeah. But it's not all beer brewers. It's like just like some beer brewers in St. Louis are part of the Teamsters Union.
Someone knew a guy who knew a guy, and now we're all part of the same happy family.
Now we're in the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the logo of which has two horsies on it. Which needs to be said.
Mm-hmm. It is transport, after all.
I'm saying. So for 30-plus years, the general drivers of the local 574 Teamster Union had been pretty much lifeless in Minneapolis until that federal piece of legislation from Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1933. Within weeks of that 1933 law, local 574 Teamsters gained over 100 members, largely in the coal truck driving industry. And as you know, Minneapolis is cold as fuck for a lot of the year. The summer of 1933... is when, like I said, it was June 1933 this got signed. So it's summer, but as the weather gets colder, coal deliveries are going to become more and more important. You know, Santa's got to give something out to naughty children.
Someone's got to warm the house somehow.
Exactly.
Let the kids bring it all in.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And by January 1st of 1934, the Teamsters at the local 574 organized a truck driver's like strike at various coal yards, and they had their demands ready. Union recognition, increased pay, shorter hours, improved working conditions, overtime payment. The regional labor board organizes discussions between the Teamsters and the Citizens Alliance. Like, before anyone goes on strike, they were just like, we're organized, here's our demands, can you please
talk.
Pay? I think they were asking for 65 cents an hour, which in today's dollars is $15.66.
Never mind.
Which, I mean, yeah, to be one of the most important... I would argue one of the most important workers in Minneapolis and making $15.66 in today's dollars is, like, crazy.
To, like, keep people warm in their homes when it's negative 25?
Literally. So, unfortunately, one of the directors of the Citizens Alliance, so you remember the Citizens Alliance?
I do.
The Alliance of Businessmen. If you had to describe their lair, how would you describe it?
Underground. Like, no question. Mm-hmm. Because it's Minneapolis, by some type of body of water.
Okay.
With some type of, like, illicit, you know, there's like, a boat out there everyone's gambling on, or there's, like, there's something going on on the river.
But it's very wet.
Wet, cold, dark, depressed Batman.
Yeah,
okay. Is kind of what I'm thinking.
So, Batman steps out of the cave, and his name in this case is J.B. Beardsley, which does sound like a fake name. He comes from Pittsburgh or something. He joins the party late. And like I said, these discussions start in January of 1934. Beardsley joins, I think, February-ish. And he flat out refuses to meet with any union representative because they won't come underground to him. No, I'm just kidding. he said he won't meet with them because they, quote, mean just exactly nothing to me.
So, I mean, pretty much what you just said. They're worse than dirt to him.
Yeah, truly. He was like, I could not care how wet they are or if they also enjoy hanging out under the river with me.
Yeah. If they emanate heat, I don't care.
Right. So that's not great. Wednesday, February 7th. Okay, that's exactly what I meant. It is 0 degrees outside in Minneapolis. Teamsters decide now's the time to strike. They close all but two of every single Minneapolis coal yard. Period. They start picketing both outside, like, in their jackets because it's 0 degrees outside, but also in their cars. When they see any truck with coal driving around the city, they close in on it and then they dump all the coal into the streets.
Wow. Free coal for everyone.
But they're like, we are not fucking around, you know? Like, we all make shit money for this. Mm-hmm. So if anyone's going to scab or try and break the strike, like, we're going to show them we mean business and just dump your fucking supply on the street. Fuck you. This proved to be pretty effective. The local 574 Teamsters received some union recognition from the businesses allied with the Citizens Alliance. There's like a paperwork back and forth that is so tedious and described at length in the book. But the Teamsters and Citizens Alliance keep up their petty girl fight until May. It must be stated at this point that the Citizens Alliance underestimated just how pissed off this Teamsters union was. You would think you'd get the point by them
dumping coal in the streets.
Dumping coal in the streets and, like, literally to be mad at all and stand outside in 0 degree weather, I would assume they're pretty mad.
I mean, the anger gets your blood boiling, so it, like, heats you up a little bit, but I don't know. Maybe it's a good time to be striking at that point.
You couldn't pay me, though, to go outside at all.
No.
0 degrees outside. Nope. Especially in the 30s. You, like, I don't know.
You come home with, like, missing two fingers.
Yeah, literally.
It was a good day out there.
And the doctors are just like, I don't know. People miss two fingers sometimes.
Yeah, it
happens. So, like, that's crazy. They were pissed off enough to go out and do that. So like I said, the Citizens Alliance majorly underestimates how pissed off these Teamsters are. And then in May, they decide to start another strike. I think it's May 16th, but I'm probably going to fuck up these dates. May 16th, the Teamsters close every single car or truck from entering Minneapolis.
Whoa.
Period. Even the police chief admitted that the union thoroughly had the city tied up. Like, the cops were not prepared for this. The Citizens Alliance was not prepared for this. Everyone's like, fuck, we got to deal with these Teamsters somehow. And speaking of police, the Citizens Alliance is, of course, thoroughly buddy-buddy with the Minneapolis Police Department. Police generally favor rich people with property to protect. It's not a surprise. So the general trucking Minneapolis strike had started, again, I think May 16th. For days, the Teamsters ruled the streets, prevented most, like, fruit transport from getting into the city. Business owners were, to put it mildly, gagged. So gagged, in fact, they were prepared to go to war about it. At a meeting at the West Hotel on May 17th, an unnamed local businessman suggested his own way of stopping the strike. So he gets up on a podium or something, or maybe he's shouting from the back. I don't know. What height do you picture him as? Unnamed local businessman.
Like Lord Farquaad.
Picture Lord Farquaad. Okay, standing in the back of the meeting. Everyone's like, rabble, rabble, what do we do about these Teamsters that block in the whole city? He stands up and he says, we'll volunteer as deputies if the authorities have not got the necessary manpower. Wild cheers erupt from the room. They're all ready to put on cop clothes and get a baton and just do it themselves. Did you ever watch Succession?
No, I have not.
One of the funny it's like a show about business. Mm-hmm. One of the bread and butter, I guess, of the show is their gratuitous violent metaphors when it comes to business that they're doing. So they'd say, like, you know, we're ogres fighting in the mud, or this is a quote from the show, I'm gonna grind his fucking bones to make my bread. Or it's like Jaws, if everyone in Jaws worked for Jaws.
Okay, it paints a vivid picture.
So that's the kind of things they say in Succession, right? And there's a scene that's amazing. They're all on a plane and they're talking about being like ogres fighting in the mud. And then one of them pipes up and is like, it's documents. It's, we're talking about papers. Yeah. So I think of that scene whenever I think about the Citizens Alliance, someone saying like, we're going to put on deputy outfits and we're going to do it ourselves. And everyone's cheering. It's like, girl, this is about paying people more money.
Right.
It's documents. It's figures, it's facts, it's shareholder value. Like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Why be reasonable where you could put on a costume and go have fun with your friend?
This is, you know what? They were fighting the male loneliness epidemic in that West Hotel in 1933 or 4 or whatever. So, again, I'm being 100% for real, though, that they did plan on going to war. The Citizens Alliance approaches the Minneapolis Police Department for help, and then they put the following ad into a newspaper. Again, they'll fucking post anything in a newspaper. They send out a special appeal proclaiming that, quote, manpower is our only safety. In the face of property destruction and a general condition of rioting existing in Minneapolis as a result of professional agitators and communists, the welfare and safety of Minneapolis and its citizens is at stake. This appeal is to you, personally, and through you to any friends, relatives, neighbors, or business associates or employees personally known to you for their integrity. So then this is the book that I read, the union book. Quote, every citizen of this kind was asked to report to the headquarters of the Citizens Alliance Army at 1328 Hennepin Avenue, where they would be sworn in as special police officers or deputy sheriffs. They were instructed to wear rough clothes and to be ready for service. They were not issued military uniforms, rifles, or bayonets, or given any training. They were just told, you are deputized and you are allowed to do whatever we tell you in this skirmish. So you've got all these angry, like, neighbors and business people showing up, dying to punch someone different. You know what mm-hmm. I mean?
Well, I mean, they just got through the Depression. They got a lot of stuff to work out.
This is still 1933, so we're still in... Yeah. We're depressed.
They are depressed. Yeah. They're actively depressed.
This is how you fight depression, men.
Get by fighting off, other people.
Get off your ass and work. No. So they recruited inmates from the city jail, doctors, lawyers, friends, and businessmen. They were prepared for war. Again, over documents, papers, and wages. Anyways, this is back to the book. Quote, the plan to break the union's control over Minneapolis streets was revealed the next day, Saturday, May 19th, when two trucks were loaded under the armed guard of Minneapolis policemen and the newly recruited special deputies. When unarmed picketers attempted to talk to the driver, they were beaten unconscious with clubs and pipes.
Wow.
Oops.
All right, they went for it.
They went for it. That evening, there's an undercover detective that's in the union, okay? And that's not good. You hate when that happens. His name is James O'Hara.
James. Jimmy.
He says to people, like, listen, guys, I know that they're going to plan, like, another set of trucks going out, so we have to disrupt. We have to picket these trucks going out. They're going out tonight. They're going out in the alleys of the Journal and the Tribune newspapers. So we have to be there to stop those trucks from going out. And James O'Hara specifically recruited the wives of union members and, like, just women in general to come and, like, make sure we stop, you know, we picket properly and, like, da-da-da-da. Trapped in narrow alleys, the picketers were then, of course, viciously beaten because there were no trucks going out. The cops were just there ready to beat the fuck out of everybody.
You never know when a truck can go out.
20 of the women, battered and completely bloodied, were hospitalized with broken legs, and, like, a bunch of them were left completely unconscious.
Oh, my God.
I can't stress this enough, overpaying workers more money. Like, an undercover detective infiltrates the organization to send 30 women to get the fuck beaten out of them to stop paying truckers more money?
65 cents an hour.
Yes, it's not 65 cents an hour.
That's a lot of ballyhoo for that.
I love the clinking of both of our ice as we take a drink. On Monday, May 21st, the Citizens Alliance arranged for 6 trucks to be moved, to actually be moved. That's not a fake thing.
So it took them 2 days to say, okay, now we're doing this.
Yeah.
That's a quick turnaround. All right, these are determined people.
So this isn't like the business owners arranged for 6 trucks to be moved. When you don't plan a sneak attack on 30 women in the dark alley under cover of night, you actually do have a much weaker chance of winning. So I'm going to, again, read from the book. Quote, the Citizens Alliance was now confident that the trucks could be moved. Several hundred police officers, supported by a similar force of special deputies, were stationed in the street ready to convoy the trucks and break the strike. When the first truck started to move, over 500 club-swinging picketers charged into the police lines. The employer's army and local 574 supporters were finally locked in a ferocious hand-to-hand combat. When the battle raged, another 600 strikers marched into the market area in military formation to join the battle. The injured bodies of deputies, policemen, and strikers soon littered the pavement. It's crazy. Sorry, that was me. That wasn't the book saying that. No, and finally, at the end of the day, after all that fighting, after hundreds of people are marching in military formation against the police, which the police are the police, they have batons and weapons, no trucks moved that day. So the local 574 decidedly won the battle, and the hearts and minds of the general public, who were like, why is the police doing war on you guys? So that brings us to Tuesday, May 22nd, 1934. By the morning, the Citizens Alliance and the Teamsters were, I mean, ready for a fucking fight. I'm just, again, going to read from Milliken's account of the morning, which, again, it reads like a war novel. And this is just about, it's about like a union in 1930. Okay. Quote, the police were met by a huge throng of picketers and thousands of onlookers. By midday, the market district had erupted into an immense battleground. Armed with every conceivable improvised weapon, from large stones and machine bolts to baseball bats and wagon wheel spokes, the strikers concentrated their attack on the easily identifiable special deputies, which again are like the dudes in rough clothing, which I'm kind of dying to know what people in the 1930s thought would be like rough-looking, intimidating clothing. You know, like...
But also during the Depression, like, you don't have to dirty anything up. You know, you're just like, okay, yeah, like, this is what I have.
But it says, like, pants that are up to your nipples, you know,
probably,
like,
yeah.
Suspenders for some reason.
Just something you can, like, melodically beat something to. Walking down the street with a watermelon to bash over the head.
It's like a comedian from the 80s.
Yeah.
quote, blood-soaked men fell to the street and the carnage quickly mounted. The employer's soldiers, outnumbered and beaten, fled for their lives, tossing their nightsticks and badges onto the street. The regular Minneapolis police hung back and refused to fire their weapons. Although the battle lasted less than an hour, Union pickets continued to track down and attack special deputies through the evening. A Citizens Alliance Army headquarters, Colonel Watson and Major Harrison, managed to escape a threatening crowd by brandishing shotguns and sidearms. The Battle of Deputies Run, as it came to be called, was a complete rout. Citizens Alliance director Arthur Lehman lay dead from a fractured skull. The Citizens Alliance Army was defeated, never to regroup. I can't emphasize this enough. One of the Citizens Alliance directors died fighting in the streets so that he could not pay people 65 cents an hour. This death is often portrayed by, I can only assume, like, pro-business or just, like, historically incurious people as, like, look at how violent the union people were, etc. But this was an army organized by the Citizens Alliance and then responded to by the Teamsters.
Like 4 days of attacks, and then they're like, ah, all right, now it's our turn.
Right. And so he gets beaten by some sort of improvised weapon, like a stone or a machine bolt, takes one to the head, fractures his skull, and dies. I mean, that doesn't come out of nowhere. Again, I'm not saying it's great to start killing business dudes, but also it can't be presented without any context. You know what I mean?
If you don't knock someone out by the fourth round, they will hit you in the fifth. And he learned that the hard way.
Yeah, like I said, he died doing what he loved.
Not paying people and fighting workers.
Yeah. So Minnesota's governor, Floyd Olson, steps in. He declares martial law at some point. I can't remember if it's this round or the next round, and I just didn't bother to double check by the time I sat down with you. But this, the National Guard is sent in after this May group of strikes, and this guy dies. And so it's quelled for the moment by way of Floyd Olson sort of lying to both parties about what we're going to agree on. And, you know, both sides realize this is a temporary truce because the governor doesn't want there to be a literal civil war happening in Minnesota. So in May, this sort of gets quelled after this guy dies. For the next few months, the Citizens Alliance goes back to their usual strategy. The police themselves beg the city for more money for bayonets and machine guns so that they're not caught sleeping again. And the Citizens Alliance set of interests leads to a blitzkrieg of newspaper articles attempting to turn the public against the union. Again, tale as old as time, here's a quote from the Minneapolis Star on July 3rd, quote, "Are the communists insidiously taking over union labor organizations? Union labor organizations are reputable and patriotic, but are communists taking it over to achieve the Russianizing of Americans?"
And who was that article written by, Tucker Carlson?
It's like the classic just asking questions type of disinformation strategy that, like, is familiar to me as my eyelids are at this point. Like, yeah. I've seen it everywhere. Is it do you think that the people doing the wokeness are actually the bad guys?
This was a part of that Instagram feed that you were talking about before that didn't exist until, I guess, right now. Now they learned, oh, wait, let's get some more salacious stuff in here.
So long story short, on July 16th, the Teamsters go on strike again. You know, like, there's only a set of temporary measures that are put in place that basically everybody's like, this is not a solution. So July 16th, time to go on strike again. The strikes go on for a few days that, again, are tediously represented in the book. But on Friday, July 20th, 90 degrees outside. So we've done a complete 180 from our initial set of strikes. 2 p.m., hot sun scorching down onto the sidewalk. People are sweating in their 1930s-ass clothes. You know, people wore so many clothes in the past.
Right. Yeah, like 6 layers on.
Yeah. A truck pulls into the back of, I think, a grocery store with 25 police cars escorting it. The officers are now souped up with submachine guns and a variety of other riot-quelling technology. There's some cornflakes and some oatmeal that are loaded onto the truck, and I assume some other mishmash of disgusting 1930s gruel. It's the Depression. Yeah. It's cornflakes, oatmeal, and gruel. Someone's loading this truck with the intention of shipping it out, which, again, we're not doing because we're on strike. So we get a whole, like, thousands of people flooding into the streets to try and get this truck to not move anymore. When the delivery truck attempted to leave, it's cut off by a union truck. The riot police then get out of their 25 vehicles, cock their guns at the strikers in the huge crowd, and fire to kill. 67 strikers were shot, 40 of whom were shot in the back as they ran away from the police shooting indiscriminately into the crowd. Two men, John Baylor and Henry Ness, died in the event that became known as Bloody Friday in Minneapolis history. The funeral for these two men, the act of simply remembering these two dudes who died, spurred an overwhelming amount of flooding into the streets a few days later, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. You're nodding vigorously. Mm-hmm. To make another long story short, the Minneapolis general strike, you know, it's already in full swing, but it's just even more in full swing now. And it goes through August 22nd, at which point many of the union's demands are met. to, you know, put it simply.
Good. It's about time.
So that's kind of how we end the story of where these Teamsters start striking, get their goals, achieve what they want. But it was a long and bloodied history to get to that point. As like a weird postscript, the local 574 were for some reason booted by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters in 1935, but then reinstated as local 544. I don't know why.
I've seen that happen. It's like when a frat gets kicked off campus and then you bring them back 2 years later under a different name. You're like, ah, we don't associate ourselves with you, but...
I actually have never heard that. I didn't know that that could happen.
Now you do.
Were you in a frat?
Nope. But we did have one get kicked off campus when I was at Indiana.
Mm.
And then they came back a couple years later with a fake name.
Better than ever.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you've made the connection yet, but Bloody Friday happened on July 20th. The act of, again, simply remembering these two men, Henry Ness and John Baylor, is what spurred Minneapolis into this overwhelming set of pro-union demonstrations. If we're to celebrate the anniversary of this event a year later, it might turn us into a bunch of communist pussies, you know what I mean? So how do you, as a businessman, answer that quandary of all these people are getting together to remember these union guys, and it's kind of a drag, and the more people think about unions, the more they want to unionize. So what do? Introducing the Minneapolis Aquatennial, sponsored by every local business in the area that make up the fabric of our great city. The Minneapolis Aquatennial is the third weekend of July, and it's supposed to take place over 10 days. The Founding Fathers said that this is the best weather of the year, the third week of July, and certainly not 90 degrees outside, even in 1934. So that's kind of why we get the Aquatennial celebrated in Minneapolis, is all these business leaders got together and said, like, what's an event that we can put on to, you could say, to put it not cynically, like, increase tourism or, like, take our minds off of events that are super depressing. But it's like, what are those depressing events, ma'am?
Who caused those events?
Yeah. So that's why every single event is like, a you know, the Target branded fireworks or like the, you know, whatever it is, beauty pageant, et cetera, et cetera. So in conclusion, come on, girl. But yes, that is, and also this isn't like just my read on why there's the Aquatennial. Like most labor papers or history things will be like, yeah, that's why they made the Aquatennial. Of course, there's no transcript of the meeting where they like rubbed their hands together and said, this is, we're going to do it to distract from the union thing. But like, come on, girl.
Let's have everyone go outside to do this event during the most humid, hot week of the entire year.
And make it
in
10,
Minnesota.
It's not 10 days long anymore, but it used to be 10 full fucking days. They used to have, quote, fat lady races. Like, I guess in the Depression, they were just like impressed if you like had enough food, I guess.
And could run.
Yeah, I'm dying to know what they counted as fat lady races in 1934. You know, I'm sure I would qualify.
Yeah, give me a picture of that instead of 1965.
So yeah, that's the story kind of behind the Minneapolis Aquatennial.
Wow.
Did you learn?
I sure did. I'm very grateful that the strike was in the summer and not the winter. But who knows? Maybe if it was in the winter, I would have gone at some point in my life.
True. And I know that this is going to sound sarcastic, but it's not. It's a kind of comforting for me to know that things have always been that bad.
Yeah.
Like, we think things are bad now, but it's like businessmen got together and went to war. And they do that in different ways now, but they literally used to take to the streets with batons and guns and say, we are going to kill you if you ask for union membership.
A nickel more? Sorry.
Yeah, fuck you. I will kill you. So again, it's not like things are amazing today, but it's like, oh, okay, they've always been bad. That's weirdly comforting to me. So yeah, I don't know if I just have really fucked up taste.
No, I'm with you. Mm. Things have always been bad. They're... is fun, it sounds like, in these fat lady races.
Yes!
And everything going on.
It is fun, and it's like, you know, we can always just, like, learn from the playbook of the past, too. Like, there's nothing new is really being employed anymore.
You're so right.
Other than, like, the tech it takes to do it, but it's like, you could still call something communist today, and people would be like, I don't think I trust it. You know, like, that strategy, quite literally with the words, down to the words, still works. Of course, you can use DEI or woke or transgender or whatever, and, like, that's the strategy, but you could also arguably still use communist, and people would still be like, I don't like it.
Whatever people call Ballyhoo.
Yeah.
Put that in.
I'm bringing Ballyhoo back.
Yeah. No, that's like, I added that word to my vocabulary. That's what I've learned most out of our discussion today.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining me on this episode of Busted Business Bureau.
Oh, yeah, you betcha.
It's been almost an hour.
Wow. Fantastic. I learned so much.
Is there anything you want to plug on the way out or anything you want to say?
Honestly, no, not really.
Amazing.
Come to the Lincoln Lodge, support live comedy.
Oh, stop it, Archie. Archie's going to be in the upcoming PowerPoint Night Live All-Stars on September 28th, I think, at 7:30 p.m.
True, and now I have one less topic to do.
Thanks, Archie.